The basic idea of this talk is what can we believe about our legends of superheroes? And like a lot of kids when I was growing up, of course, I read all of the comic books. And after a while, when you look at science fiction and comic books, you get a sense that, of course, it's fantasy, but maybe there's something behind the fantasy that feels real. So the question, was Buddha just a nice guy, will become clear as we go in the talk here. But the essence of it is, was Buddha just a nice guy or maybe something more? And for Buddha, we can substitute other names of our favorite religious figures. Well, there are three ways of entering this question, and they all have to do with what we think is going on with the nature of consciousness. So from a mainstream science perspective today, consciousness is generated by the brain. That's the neuroscience point of view. And basically, it rests on this kind of image. Let me replay that because it can go a little bit longer. So if we take an anatomical perspective, we're just looking at the physical structure that we call the brain. It's inside there. We look at it more closely. We see these kinds of things. Somehow, consciousness is in there, but we don't know yet exactly where it is. We do know that the structure, the brain, can give rise to all sorts of things that we would consider to be pretty subtle, including ethics and morality of yourself and ethics and morality that you attribute to others. So these brain functions are interrupted through disease or injury, then you no longer can perceive the ethics and morality of other people or of yourself. If you use a functional MRI, while people are simply perceiving the intentions or the moralities of other people, certain portions of your brain will light up. That means that if those portions are scooped out of your brain, then you will at least momentarily become a psychopath, because you would not be able to perceive intentions or morality of other people. There are circuits. There are reverberating circuits in the brain that have to do with the notion of empathy. And in fact, almost anything you can think of subjectively, there are portions of your brain that are involved in controlling those feelings. So it's not surprising then that within the neurosciences, this is the view that we're taught, and this is the view that most neuroscientists would accept. There is a structure in your head that kind of looks like this. The structure is regarded in a mechanical sense, almost like a robot, and there are gears, and the gears turn, and that's what gives rise to every aspect of your subjective experience, including your awareness. This is the current scientific view. A completely different view is one that says that the brain is important in our subjective sense, but it's reflecting consciousness, where consciousness is something that's fundamental. And so in this sense, it's more that the brain is like a radio receiver, and it comes out of these traditions. And the contemplative traditions, when people sit down long enough and just meditate, they get a sense that consciousness is really fundamental in some way, and that our brain and our perceptions reflect this ability in an important way. As an aside, Michelangelo, in drawing the Sistine Chapel and other works, he was a master anatomist, among other things. And so here's this famous picture of God giving life to Adam, and the cross-section of God's robe was in the shape of a cross-section of the brain. And so art historians have found many parallels in the works of Michelangelo, showing that he put anatomical features in his drawings. There are people who are looking for mystical and religious indicators within the brain. For example, the chemicals associated with the experience of God. One such a chemical is dimethyltryptamine, the endogenous form of DMT. Another are locations in the brain that are associated with things like a religious epiphany. There are studies of spiritual virtuosos, people who have spiritual experiences pretty much at will. And there are certain areas of the brain that are associated with this. There's a whole realm of biology of belief. And interesting things about the brain in respect to near-death experiences. So if you ask neuroscientists, is the brain hardwired to produce God, or is the brain hardwired to perceive God? This is a paper, a systematic review on the role of the brain in mediating religious experience by neuroscientists to see whether this experience that people have of a mystical sense or religious feeling, is this simply something that the brain produces because of its structure, or is the brain somehow receiving something? Well, the upshot of this review was that they don't know, that you can't, there's no strong way of telling yet within a current neuroscience to know, is the brain producing this or receiving? So it's an open question, and it gives rise to something like this, that it's as though the brain is a receiver, like a fancy television, and it gives us images, but the thing that is looking at the images is outside. Consciousness is watching this unfold. So the third possibility is this. The third possibility are traditions that pay a lot of attention to the energetics of the body. Now, this one, of course, is showing the classical notion of chakras. And most traditions, including shamanic traditions, have a lot that is said about the energies of the body. And from a scientific perspective, we know almost nothing about this. These kinds of energies have so far been extremely difficult for any conventional instruments in order to measure. So we don't know what those things are. And maybe this is related to consciousness, maybe not. But it's a third way of imagining what's going on when we think about consciousness. So now, with that as a bit of a background, we can address some of the stories about our favorite religious figures. This one is a picture or drawing of Buddha surrounded by flame and levitating over his disciples. This is pretty typical of the hagiography that you get, the stories of the lives of the saints, which sometimes are elaborated. Here's another famous story. This one is Charlton Heston parting the Red Sea. And here we have our favorite Jesus walking on water. These stories, from a religious perspective, are extremely important because they're part of the mythology that goes into the power of religion, the power of the religious figure. From a scientific perspective, we look at these merely as stories. From a religious perspective, we look at it as important indicators. At least within the West in many places in Europe as well are becoming pretty secular. And so religion is fading into the background and people make fun of it. So here we have the parting of the Red Sea. It was just a fluke. Here's one saying that I'm glad my name's not thou. Here we have a famous grilled cheese sandwich with the face of either Jesus or Mother Mary or the Mona Lisa, depending on your preference. This was a miracle because the grilled cheese sandwich was made before the woman who made it saw that it had Mother Mary on the grilled cheese. She took a bite out of the sandwich and the bite miraculously healed itself. So it's incorruptible. And this was then sold on eBay for $15,000 to a casino in Las Vegas, where you can see it today. If you want to see many examples of this kind of thing, you can go to a website called thingsthatlooklikejesus.com, and you will find many, many examples. I like this one. If you're too busy to meditate, you can try the Buddha patch and achieve enlightenment while you're cleaning your toilet. Also available in capsule, gel, and suppository. And then finally, if there is no God, how come the world fits so perfectly into a chicken? And actually, if you look at this carefully, you see that this actually is composed of different land masses without much distortion, and it fits nicely into a chicken, a rooster, actually. But we return again to this question, was Buddha just a nice guy? Well, Buddha, of course, is a title. And the question here is, what about the person, Siddhartha? Was Siddhartha just a nice guy? Maybe he was the George Clooney of the day. He had a good smile. He had better tan than the average person. He knew how to work a crowd. He might have been simply a celebrity, because after all, he was a prince and came from a wealthy family and was also a religious leader. So maybe that's what it is. Or maybe there's something else. So the question is, why do the stories associated with the Buddha and his teachings last for thousands of years? Was it simply because he was a celebrity or something else, something more? Well, this is the sort of thing that we study, among others, at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And this question, was Buddha just a nice guy, actually came about as a result of a meeting that the Dalai Lama has held over many years. This one is a picture on the top showing the 25th meeting between the Dalai Lama, his monks, and scientists. The Dalai Lama had initiated this series of dialogues to look at Buddhism, and Tibetan Buddhism in particular, and science, and to see how to reconcile these two wisdom traditions. So in these discussions, the Dalai Lama will bring up things that are important within the Tibetan Buddhist idea, many of which have to do with religious concepts and mystical concepts, and things like reincarnation and precognition and that sort of thing. Well, science has very little to say, at least mainstream science has very little to say about those kinds of topics. So the Dalai Lama will raise the issue, like, was Buddha just a nice guy? And from a neuroscience perspective, all they can say is, yes, he was a nice guy, but that's all he was, because there's nothing else. And so that was where I started to think about whether that is actually true or maybe not completely true. Well, the meetings with the Dalai Lama have been very useful in the sense that they've given rise to a new respectability for study of meditation. And it's given rise to a number of very good books and studies of Tibetan Buddhists with in functional MRI and EEG, and a lot has been learned in the last decade about the value of meditation. So that part's good. Here I'm giving credit to the illustrator who drew pictures of superheroes in meditative poses for my book, Supernormal. This is the book that kind of summarizes what I'm talking about. Her name, the artist's name is Selma Sirik, and she drew these images. And so what do we believe about these stories of the superpowers? Well, if we take a scientific perspective of who and what we are, it kind of looks like this. We're evolving. We've evolved from intelligent apes, and we're a caveman, and then we're a modern man, and then we're turning into that, unfortunately. And so our evolutionary track sort of looks like we're heading in this direction. I'm watching my calories, and I think I've discovered that if, in fact, you eat at fast food every day, you will be probably around 3,000 to 4,000 calories a day, which is fine if you're running a marathon like every 2 days, but it's not fine if you don't. And that's why the evolutionary track kind of looks like it's going in this direction. But there's another evolutionary picture, and this comes out of the yoga tradition, which says, yes, we've estimated that we've starting from something like a monkey, and then a proto-man, and then a Homo sapiens, but around 500 years from now, we will evolve into a siddha. A siddhi is the Sanskrit term for special attainment as a result of meditative practice, and at that point, we'll have learned to hover. So this is an evolutionary step in humankind, and 7,000 years later, we'll learn how to fly. So that's a different evolution, which I prefer, I think. Which brings us to yoga. So yoga is a good place to start, because we know that yoga is now mainstream. We know it's mainstream because it's on the cover of Time magazine. And when anything reaches the cover of Time magazine, that you know that it's mainstream, because Time is nice and they tell us that. So this is already 14 years ago that yoga was on the cover, and 10 years ago that meditation was on the cover. And it does reflect the fact that now tens of millions of people in the West and the United States, even more so in Europe, are doing yoga and meditation. And many of them probably don't recall or don't know what the origins of yoga and meditation were all about. And of course, what it's really about is about enlightenment. It's a path towards enlightenment. But in the meantime, since we tend to be very secular in the West, what is being focused on from a scientific perspective on yoga in particular are the health benefits. So we know that it's useful for treating carpal tunnel, and it's useful for back pain and PTSD in veterans and depression and insomnia and on and on and on. Many, many things. And you know that it's really mainstream when it hits the cartoons in the New Yorker. When did everyone stop jogging? So what else is yoga good for? Well, the classical book of yoga is the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. This was written about 2,000 years ago. It's made out of four small books consisting of 196 sutras, which are short aphorisms. The sutra is similar to our word for suture, meaning a thread. 196 little threads of wisdom, which captured the oral tradition at that point. So we don't know how far back yoga goes, maybe 5,000 years or more, but around 2,000 years ago, this was the first written version of what had, to that point, had been an oral tradition. The whole point of yoga is to develop samadhi. So samadhi is the Sanskrit term associated with the notion of mystical union. It's the state of mysticism in which the distinction between you and the universe begin to dissolve. It's just unity. That's all that's left. And that's what it's about. The third book of the Yoga Sutras, Vibhuti Pada. Pada means book. Vibhuti is a kind of an ash that is used in religious ceremonies. You typically will find someone putting a dot on their forehead or sometimes a stripe across the forehead. And it indicates, in a sense, symbolically, that you've burned through your training and you've now reached a certain level of achievement. The ash is symbolic of burning. So as I said, the goal of all of the yoga practice is to develop first dharana, or what we'd call concentration, and then meditation, and then samadhi, full absorption. And you do this along with an object of attention. And when you do all of those together, concentration, meditation, absorption, and attention is called sanyama or samyama. This is a term for if you can do this, you develop samadhi and you have an object of attention, you will develop certain superpowers. This is simply stated as a matter of fact in the yogic tradition. So what sort of superpowers? Well, the term siddhi is used. It roughly means perfection or attainment as a result of disciplined practice. And what are they? Well, there are roughly three different categories of special abilities that are said to be attainable. Mind-body abilities include things like super healing. And in the extreme cases, you could take a bottle of poison that you drink and you can figure out how to heal yourself immediately from that poison. Ineddiya is the ability to live perfectly well without eating or drinking. You'd have super strength, super speed, ability to become very light or to levitate, or the ability to become very heavy, which is gravitation. So those are all having to do with your mind and body. And then there's a bunch of siddhis related to clairvoyance, all about perception through space and time from the smallest to the largest. I mean, literally subatomic to the entire cosmos at large. And then psychokinetic effects, direct mind over matter effects. Now, some of the mind-body siddhis like levitation have something to do with mind over matter, but I'm separating it here because this form of psychokinesis is if you wanted to make a diamond appear, for example, or some food to appear, it would just appear. And it's not related to your body necessarily. So the Yoga Sutras describe about 25 of these special abilities that arise as a result of disciplined practice. The same cities are found in all cultures. You can find descriptions of the cities, as I said, in yoga, but in Catholicism, you find the same ones, and they're called charisms. You also find a couple of hundred other charisms that are discussed in Catholicism, but they basically all can be devolved into these three categories that I was mentioning. You find the same in Islam and Judaism, Tibetan Buddhism, all shamanic traditions. They all have descriptions of the same kinds of abilities. The difference with the yogic tradition is that in yoga, it is said that you develop these abilities. Now, you may be lucky and you may be talented and have them just naturally, but the assumption is that this is an inherent capacity. By virtue of being human, you can develop these abilities if you apply yourself sufficiently. In the religious traditions, it's often described as this is a matter of grace, that you are given a gift by God, or you're given a gift in some form, and that's where the ability comes from. So I make the distinction between an inherent ability that you can develop versus one that is given to you as a gift. So go back to this issue of, now that we've seen a little bit about the lore, religious lore, yogic lore, what does science do about these things? Well, scientists, of course, for a long time have known about the cities and the legends about them. But when you go to the laboratory, you need to find a way to take a description of an experience and operationalize it. That means to make it compatible with what we can do in the laboratory. So we have names that we've given to these kinds of effects over the years. If there are two people and some kind of information passes between them through non-ordinary means, we might call it telepathy. Psychokinesis, we would say, is somehow impressing your will or your intention out into the world at large, like in a casino. Clairvoyance is when there are aspects of the world that somehow get inside your head. And precognition, or retrocognition, is when things of the natural world get into your head, but they're either from the future or from the past. So these four terms are commonly used as ways that you can take the experiences, which are talked about in the Yoga Sutras, and actually putting them into the laboratory to test it and see if they're real. When we listen to stories that people tell us, many people have these kinds of psychic experiences, and a question would be, well, how do we understand it? So roughly half of stories that you hear are basically coincidence, that they would probably have happened purely by chance. Some of them are confabulation. Confabulation means that you have misremembered what actually occurred and you made up a better story because it just seems better. Some of the stories are just made up completely. They're fraudulent. Some are selective memory. And the only reason why this is interesting from a science perspective is that you can go through all of these explanations and more, and roughly 5% are not explainable by any known means. And that's where the science begins. So what we can do then is say, well, if that 5% means that these abilities are really real, we should be able to do experiments. So in the Yoga Sutras, book number 3, Sutras 19 and 20, talks about knowledge of minds. And this is a method, a prescription basically, that says if you want to gain knowledge of someone else's mind, you do this certain practice and you will know the other person's mind. Basically, that's quite simple, except that you have to first begin by knowing how to do samadhi. So how would we test that in the laboratory? Well, it turns out that there are many prohibitions and these traditions that say that if you develop this city, you shall not demonstrate it. And the reason you shouldn't demonstrate it is because it will inflate your ego, and that will cause you to be seduced by the power, and you will fall to the dark side. And you see this in almost any esoteric tradition, that there are warnings against demonstrating special abilities. So we can't go to the yogis and say, can you please come into the lab and demonstrate your siddhi? Instead, we go to ordinary people and hope that the Yoga Sutras are correct, that this is an inherent ability, and most people would be able to demonstrate this to a small degree. So we just recruit ordinary people to come into the lab, and we do an experiment like this. So this is the woman who has the ping pong balls over her eyes. Her name is Gail. And the lady putting the ping pong balls here, her name is Lena. She's my research assistant. And this is an experiment that has been done thousands of times now as a way of taking ordinary people and seeing if, in fact, there's some kind of telepathic rapport that exists. So the method is that you get somebody, you sit them in a comfortable chair, you put on the ping pong balls, you ask them to keep their eyes open while you shine a red light on their face. And then you have them wear headphones over their ears and tell them to relax for about 20 minutes. If you imagine yourself in such a position, this is called, by the way, the Ganzfeld condition. It's a German word meaning whole field. It envelops your whole head into an unpatterned sensory state. There's no pattern that you can see with your eyes, and there's no pattern with your ears. And after about 10 minutes in this state, most people find it pleasant, but you begin to hallucinate. You begin to go into a dreamlike state because your brain becomes starved for information. You're awake, your eyes are open, your ears are working, but nothing's happening. So it is thought that this condition would make people exceptionally sensitive to subtle impressions coming from somewhere else. So Gail now is sitting here and will play the role of the receiver in a telepathy experiment. Meanwhile, at a distance, she came with a friend named Tom. Tom was given four envelopes. The envelopes contain these four pictures. Neither Gail nor Tom knew in advance what the pictures would be. Tom was told to roll a die, and he would select one of the envelopes. He opened it up, and he took out one of these images. And he's told to send this image to Gail at a distance. They were in different parts of the same building, but no, completely out of touch from each other. So Tom selects one of the images, tries to mentally send it to Gail. This is what Gail said. Now, Gail is told to speak out loud. She's in this Ganzfeld state. She's completely isolated from the rest of the world, but things will come to mind, so she's encouraged to speak out loud. And then what she says is recorded. So she said, something has a rough texture, tall, looking up high, like in an art gallery or in a museum, a Yosemite kind of image of a tall rock, monolithic, images of Mount Rushmore, and half dome, like a big stone. So after this period of about 20 minutes, she's taken out of the Ganzfeld state. We play back everything she said to remind her, and then we show her four pictures, one of which was the one that Tom was sending, and then the three decoys that Tom hadn't even seen. And she said, asked, well, of these four pictures, which one do you think Tom was seeing and trying to send to you? So when, if you ask most people, given that that was her imagery and those were the pictures, what do you think that she was seeing? And in fact, that's what Tom was sending. So this is this would be considered a hit as opposed to a miss. In this experiment, the chance of getting this correctly is 1 in 4. So even though this is a pretty dramatic hit, a clear hit, that in this one test doesn't mean anything from a scientific perspective. It's just one data point. What happens when you do this lots of times? Well, this has been done in 20 laboratories so far, 122 reported experiments, and 4,600 sessions, of which Gail's session was one. What you're looking at here is the hit rate. The dotted line is chance, 25%. And each dot and confidence interval showing the result of the 122 experiments. And we just look at this at a glance, you can see that most of them are above the chance line. Some of them aren't. Some of the experiments didn't work so well. And to see this a little bit easier, we'll take each study and accumulate the results, just because each study used the same kind of idea. They simply have hits and misses. So we just add up all of the hits, and we can plot here chance is the dotted line on the bottom. This is the overall hit rate after 4,674 sessions. And the final hit rate is there. It's 32%. The odds against chance of being at 32% rather than chance is let's see, where is it? It's 300 trillion quadrillion to one. So what this tells us is we know with very high certainty that what is happening in this experiment is not due to chance. And this has been discussed repeatedly in the psychological literature, the journals. To this point, no one has any idea about what it is if it's not telepathy. And the way that this is discussed, it goes through a list of alternative explanations for these results. Like, we know we're not getting chance. We know that we're getting more information than we should over many, many sessions by people who don't make any special claims about telepathic ability. So maybe there's some kind of leakage between the people. There's information passing, or there were recording mistakes or randomization problems and so on, all the way down to fraud. These experiments have been designed over the years to take into account each one of these alternatives as a possible loophole. And so modern experiments of this type, these explanations are no longer viable because they're designed out of the experiment. What these explanations cannot do, though, is answer this question. What if you had somebody who absolutely did not believe in telepathy and did this kind of experiment? If they tried to replicate this experiment, what would happen? And the reason this question comes up is because there's always a suspicion that if you believe in telepathy, maybe you're not being quite as careful as you would otherwise be. So up until 2005, there was no good answer to that because skeptics don't do these experiments. Well, fortunately, a pair of professors from the University of Georgia and the University of Notre Dame, they did do the experiment, the same kind of Ganzfeld experiment that I just described. And what they reported was they did 8 studies, and they had an overall statistically significant hit rate of 32%, which is just what all of these other studies have found. But then to demonstrate the amazing power of prior belief, they said this was precariously close to demonstrating humans do have psychic powers, and so we still don't believe in telepathy. Nevertheless, because they actually did the experiment and they got the same results as everyone else, this does show that skeptics doing the same procedure actually can get the same result. So this is not what we see before is not simply due to believers making mistakes. We even have skeptics saying that you haven't reported every possible telepathy study and some were left out. So the meta-analysis about the Ganzfeld is flawed in some way. Well, so I said, okay, what have we left out? So this person found another 2,000 trials or 2,000 experiments, roughly the same as the Ganzfeld, but not using that particular method, using other methods than the Ganzfeld. And so the overall hit rate was not 32%, it was 30%, where 25% would be chance. The overall odds against chance is 289 gazillion to one. And so I was curious as then why was the skeptic so insistent that the meta-analysis had to be flawed if the addition of all these other trials actually gives you a better result because there's more data? And so he didn't have an answer to that. And again, it shows that people believe what they want to believe independent of the data. And even though in this case, actually, the additional data helped in terms of overall evidence. So people believe what they want to believe, I guess. So there's pretty strong evidence for telepathy. There is converging, repeatable evidence that telepathy exists beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, remember that the reason why I mentioned this is to go back to the Yoga Sutras and ask whether Patanjali was making up fairy tales. You know, here he's writing a book and he's describing, here's how you would have mind-to-mind communication. As a matter of fact, done deal, it exists. Well, This kind of phenomenon has been tested in the laboratory now for over four decades. And we find that potentially he was right about telepathy. Well, what about the 25 other cities? Like, we don't see people levitating today, but maybe that's because the ones who can levitate are taking the prohibition seriously and they're not demonstrating it. But what we, and also we can't bring them into the lab. They don't want to demonstrate it. But what we can do is take what we would consider to be more elementary cities like telepathy and clairvoyance and see whether there is evidence for that in the laboratory. So we know that it's true for telepathy. Are you not thinking what I'm not thinking? So let's consider an area of mind-matter interaction. As I said, a number of the cities that are described in the Yoga Sutras have to do with direct mind-matter interaction. I'm not talking about bending your spoon with my mind, although that is one of the things that people do sometimes. I'm talking instead about a series of studies that we and others have been involved in, looking at the strange nature of quantum phenomena, where there's something about knowledge or information that so-called collapses the quantum wave function. What this means is that if you take a classic setup like a double slit system and you shine light through two slits, that you get a certain pattern of light on the screen. But this only occurs if you don't know which of the two slits that the light goes through. If you do know, if you're able to look and measure which one it goes through, then you get a very different pattern of light. And this demonstrates the so-called wave and particle duality of light. It behaves differently depending on what you know about it. So we've been testing this now for the last 7 years or so in our laboratory with a very simple setup, a laser, a filter to cut down the illumination, a double slit, and a camera. And what we do is we ask people to simply imagine with their mind that they could see what's happening in the vicinity of the double slit. And by so doing, can they gain information out of the system and cause it to stop behaving like waves and start behaving like particles, purely with their mind. That's what the device looks like. The tube on the left is the laser. It goes about halfway inside the metal box. There's a double slit in the middle, and then there's a camera at the right end of that box. And there I am working on the inside of the box. So this is summarizing a lot of work here. There's 250 sessions involving humans and 250 sessions that are controls that are run without humans present. The controls are on the top. Zero means there's no difference in what's happening and when you observe versus don't observe in the system. And the bottom is what the actual data looks like when humans are involved over six experiments. The vertical axis in terms of Z-score, which tells you statistically how important it is. And when you get down to Z-scores of -3, -4, -5, you have very strong statistical evidence that the act of observing the system with your mind's eye is causing it to behave in a different way. It's actually behaving more like a particle, light as a particle rather than light as a wave. You see that in experiment number 5, there was a very big result where the line moves down very quickly in experiment 5. That's because the previous four experiments were pilot tests where we were selecting people who we didn't know yet whether they would be able to do this task. These are just ordinary people, but some are able to do it better than others. So experiment 5, we selected out everyone that seemed to do well. So we're using people with some measure of talent and just use those people in the experiment, and they did very, very well. So again, those are the system unobserved. This is the system observed. We then also kept track as to whether people were meditators or non-meditators. The meditators tend to do better, quite a bit better than the non-meditators. I think the reason for this, the meditators have almost odds against chance of 300,000 to 1. The meditators are able to do this, I think, not because they're practicing the cities, but because they can hold their attention on the task. And this is all about how you focus your attention. And it's an abstract task focus your attention on the inside of a box. Well, they're able to do that, and the non-meditators can't do that. We published this in the journal Physics Essays in 2012. We've since published another one in the same journal last year, and we're about to publish one this year, too. Well, what about the other cities? We don't see people flying around like Superman, but in principle, if you pay attention to the Yoga Sutras, there ought to be people who have abilities that are kind of like this. What do we think about those? Well, science has yet to have Superman come to the lab, so we don't know about Superman. But what we do know with high confidence are a couple of elementary cities. We have with high confidence that telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, and psychokinesis, both individual and collective, there's very good evidence that all of those are real. And this, of course, was said by Patanjali and many others. But rather than simply using stories now, we have good reason to believe that these things are actually really do exist. They all have certain commonalities. One is that the phenomena are independent of space and time. In fact, if that were not a commonality, then psychic phenomena and mystical experience would not be considered strange at all. The only reason they are considered strange is because they're not dependent on space and time in a conventional sense. We might think of these things as a first sense rather than as a sixth sense. In other words, psychic abilities are not something added on to our ordinary abilities. They come prior to ordinary abilities, most likely. And we know that they're modulated by talent, experience, belief, emotion, empathy, motivation, openness, and perhaps by activation of the right hemisphere of the brain rather than the left. These are all correlates to improved performance. Science, for the 130 years that science has been looking at this, the usual response to these kinds of abilities is good luck getting it peer-reviewed. In other words, there's a built-in skepticism into the scientific progress or process, and you need to get your work peer-reviewed in order to have the currency of scientific evidence. And it's not so easy, because science is based on a certain series of assumptions, and these kinds of phenomena challenge those assumptions. But that doesn't mean it's not getting in the journals. As I said, we've had a number of our articles published in physics journals, and our colleagues are getting it into mainstream psychology journals, so there's slow progress in that regard. So here's the conclusions. The first conclusion is that science has confirmed that some cities do exist. So this means that when we think about, was Buddha just a nice guy, at least as written in the Yoga Sutras, some of the abilities that Buddha and others were said to have had are probably real. And that's probably one of the reasons why at the time and even till now that the teachings of these religious figures are considered to be important, because they actually were able to do something that illustrate our actual potentials. Another conclusion, most of the cities and most of the really dramatic psychic and mystical experiences have not been systematically studied by science. This is partially because it's very difficult to get these things to reveal themselves on demand, which is what we need, and also because of the prohibitions among most of these methods that say don't demonstrate them, that you'll get stuck in demonstrating them, and that will deflect you from your goal, which is enlightenment. A third conclusion is that the explanations, and I'm talking here about theoretical explanations for this, that are compatible with science, will require major advancements in the neurosciences and in physics. Now, fortunately, physics has advanced, and I would make a claim, as I have in some of my previous books, that the direction that physics is moving and has moved over the past century or so is becoming increasingly compatible with the notion that there are certain things that are not locked in space and time. The whole issue of quantum phenomena is not a space-time phenomena, nor is relativistic effects. Well, you need physics to embrace those kinds of ideas in order for psychic and mystical experiences to be true. And one of the reasons why you find especially psychologists rejecting the idea of telepathy or precognition or any of these abilities is because they don't actually know what physics says is possible. I hear many times the notion that these things can't be true because they violate the laws of physics. And my response is, which laws are you talking about? And if the psychologist is talking, they have no idea. They don't know what physics allows. Well, physics does allow for things to be separated in space and time and to exist perfectly well in the world we live in. In fact, that is fundamentally, it is the nature of the world that we live in. So physics is the place, the future that will allow us to begin to explain these kinds of phenomena, I think. The last conclusion is progress. Scientific progress in this area is very slow, and every minor advancement is absurdly controversial. Again, this is because of the skeptical nature of science, which is proper, I think. Progress is slow because there's almost no money at all. Very, very few foundations are interested in supporting this. There's no government funding for it. Progress is slow, and that means there's very few people who are actually trained scientists who are looking into these kinds of phenomena. It's one of the things that makes our Institute of Noetic Sciences unique, because it is one of the core scientific questions that we're following up. So there's the book that came out, which I do a summary of this, and if you prefer it in French, the French translation came out a little while ago. There are other translations in progress as well. And this says what I'm giving you in summary in this talk, but in much greater detail. And of course, that book is available anywhere books are sold. Was Buddha just a nice guy? Well, maybe he was a nice guy. A case could be made that at least initially he wasn't a very nice guy, because after all, he left his wife and his children to go traipse around in the forest for years in order to become enlightened. And then finally he was enlightened, well, then he became nicer. And maybe sometimes our religious figures don't need to be so nice to other people. They're trying to pull us up by our bootstraps and bring us into another state of being. But was he just a nice guy? Well, he was probably more than just that. He also had special abilities, which actually raises a paradox in that you're not supposed to demonstrate the special abilities, but our major religious figures do. Of course, the reason that they do is typically said that it's a lesson for people to learn. But on the other hand, it's also in mythology, it's what creates Darth Vader. So Darth Vader is somebody who has Jedi powers, as in the Star Wars idea, and he let his ego get in the way, and he fell. He went to the dark side. And this theme repeats itself in all of the esoteric traditions. So there we are at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. What we do is we're studying the nature of consciousness. So we're kind of looking at ourselves in as scientific a way as we can manage. And ultimately, we imagine that we're consciousness looking at consciousness, which is looking at consciousness in a recursion that goes possibly all the way up to the top. And so here we are looking at the entire presentation I just did, all in a little tiny slide, and trying to make sense of it all. And so with that, I thank you for your kind attention, and I guess maybe now we can go for some questions.
Could you summarize a little bit about what you think the actual relation between the brain and the mind is?
What's the relation between the brain and the mind? Well, as I said in the very beginning of this talk, that there's at least two major ways of thinking about it. The standard neuroscience approach, which, by the way, if you go to the website of the Society for Neuroscience, this is the large neuroscience organization around the world, and if you go to their annual meeting, you will find 30,000 people there. It's a really large academic effort now. they have on their website a very nice brochure which summarizes the contemporary view of what neuroscience believes about the state of subjectivity and cognition and perception and everything else having to do with the sense of being aware. And from that perspective, your entire inner life, your memories, your thoughts, your awareness, your emotions, all of it is completely dependent on the operation of the brain. So most neuroscientists will agree that what we really are able to measure in the brain using EEG or functional MRI and other methods, what we see are correlations between mental activity and behavior of the brain. The correlations are very clear. The interpretation of the correlation, though, is that the brain is generating the effect. And that is an assumption. It's a projection or an inference of what the correlation's about. Maybe that's right, and maybe it's not so right. So if it wasn't for evidence from psychic phenomena and mystical experience, that interpretation would be very difficult to counter. But because we know that there's very good evidence for things like telepathy and clairvoyance, it raises a serious question about whether or not the correlation is understood correctly. Because the same correlation would be seen if the brain was some very sensitive equivalent of a radio receiver and was receiving consciousness, which is simply out there somehow. From a yogic perspective, consciousness is as fundamental as the physical universe. It's another substance, so-called, or type of substance that's simply there. It's part of the fabric of reality. In which case, the physical brain becomes a very finely tuned instrument that is able to receive or perceive that consciousness. You find among a growing number of philosophers that the notion of panpsychism makes more sense than any other way of thinking about where consciousness arises. And panpsychism, of course, is saying that some degree of awareness or sentience is present at every stage of existence, all the way down to electrons and below. So we wouldn't think of an electron having the same sense of self-awareness as we do, because it's not as complex. But by the same token, we would expect through panpsychism that the planet itself would have a certain degree of sentience. And perhaps the solar system would, and perhaps the galaxy and so on, that at every stage of physical complexity, you will have sentience. It's simply there as a matter of course. So maybe something like that is going on with the brain as well. And that is much more compatible an explanation for things like psychic and mystical experience than trying to imagine how consciousness arises out of the behavior of the brain itself. Because it's difficult to imagine how psychic phenomena could be explained in that way. So that's sort of a long-winded answer to what I hope was what your question was about.
Hello, I was just wondering if you attempted to achieve Siddhi, and what practices did you put into place in order to work at it, or are you just pretty much studying it?
Well, I have a meditative practice. I started doing research on this book about 3 years ago. And in the process, I reviewed most of the studies on the mental and physical benefits of meditation. And I had done meditation practice sporadically over the previous 40 years. And I would do it sometimes and then stop and so on. But after going through the modern research on the benefits, I decided it would be stupid not to meditate. In the same sense, but in almost exactly the same sense that it would be stupid not to brush your teeth every day. That it's a minor annoyance, but the consequences over the long term are just, you know, you don't need a lot of convincing that it's worthwhile. So do I spontaneously, occasionally experience things that could be considered siddhis? Yes. I think probably no more so than anybody else who's doing this sort of thing. It's very clear, though, that when the yoga tradition, and this is said even by the long-term yogis, that in order to bring the siddhis under control, meaning that it's not a spontaneous psychic effect, but something you actually do, you know how to do. In order to do that, you have to do the equivalent of live in a cave for 30 years and do nothing but meditate. And you have to live in a place on Earth where you're not being continually pounded on by electromagnetics and by other toxins in the environment and things of that sort. Well, in the modern world, we don't have the luxury of doing that anymore. I mean, you probably could find a cave somewhere and go in it, but who's going to support you? So you may need something like either natural talent. Like people who are psychics have natural talent in this domain. They didn't have to do anything to get it. They just have it genetically, perhaps. But to take an average person who may not be so talented psychically and develop these abilities, to have it under high control, requires a kind of discipline and also freedom of other responsibilities that we don't have. So I'm a scientist. My curiosity has been driven by trying to figure out what about these legendary stories are believable, and then what does that tell us about our human potential and about what is science overlooked? There's another reason why, as a scientist, I study these things, even though I don't have any special abilities, certainly not like described in the Yoga Sutras. If modern science has managed to overlook something important about the nature of human consciousness and continues with the notion that it is a mechanistic universe that we live in, that naturally leads to a sense of nihilism, that there's no purpose to anything because consciousness is just an epiphenomenon, it's a side effect, it doesn't have any meaning. And I see among college students that it gives rise to a kind of depression, like a pessimistic depression, that there's no purpose for anything. Everything is pointless because there's no inherent purpose. So if that is true, if it turns out that the reductionist materialist perspective is absolutely true and there's nothing else going on, well, we have to learn how to live with that. But it, of course, it does have consequences. It means, among other things, that it gives rise to greed. It gives rise to a sense that you only live once, and so you better grab everything you can get, on and on. All of the modern ills that we're very familiar with. But if it turns out that that's wrong even a little bit, there's really something important about consciousness that we've forgotten, or we're not using our full potentials, well, we might be ruining ourselves and the planet because of a wrong idea. And so my interest in looking at these kinds of phenomena is whether or not there might be something wrong with our assumptions, scientific assumptions. And if we corrected those assumptions, well, maybe that will make things better, because it sure can't make things any worse. So that's partially what my motivation is. The other motivation is really basic curiosity. I read a lot of science fiction and fairy tales when I was a kid, and you read enough of it, and after a while you begin to wonder, why are these topics not only said again and again, but why do they saturate our entertainment world? Everything on television and the movies are just saturated with these notions, and they take it for granted after a while. So why is that? What's the power of those stories? If it was pure fantasy that had nothing to do with reality, you think people wouldn't resonate with it very well. So that was always a curiosity I had, and it's been one of the reasons why I've looked into this in such detail. It's also, by the way, when I started looking into this many years ago, I had a very traditional training in engineering and in psychology, and I worked in traditional places. Once I started to look at these kinds of phenomena in more detail, I learned very quickly that science is not quite as rational as the textbooks say. And I thought this was fascinating, that there's as much sociology and politics that go on in the scientific construction of truth as there is in politics and government and every other domain of human affairs. And no one ever told us this. We were going through science. So I have great sympathy for my colleagues in more conventional areas who don't realize that science is embedded within a socio-political environment, that you need to know the philosophy and the history of science and the sociology of science in order to see why some work is accepted readily and others are rejected for no good reason. So that I also find to be very interesting.
I happen to have an acquaintance who supposedly has the best recorded case, documented case, of an out-of-body experience while undergoing a surgical procedure on the brain. All of the machines that were measuring her vital functions were basically showing a flat line. Yet she had an out-of-body experience, documented, was able to, when she recovered, to speak to the things that were said by the doctors when she was unconscious, her ears plugged, eyes covered, similar to the Ganzfeld experience, and also remarked upon the technique of the tools that were being used to conduct her her surgery, and a mistake or a reentry of point that was done in the procedure. The point of it is that she, when she awakened and recovered, she related this to her physician, who happened to be studying the NDEs, and he discussed it, researched it, and supposedly this, well, pardon me, it may be anecdotal, but she was legally brain dead at the time she had these observations, and she recorded them. That raises, and this became a part of a BBC news program on the NDE. Has science attempted to document cases of out-of-body consciousness or such while the subject was undergoing a condition where they were under anesthesia, where the brain could not be functioning properly, or things such as that, as a scientific examination of the process of consciousness separate from the brain?
Well, yeah, the largest scale effort of that type is by Sam Parnia, who's attempting to do experiments in the operatory where people are undergoing cardiac arrest in order to implant pacemakers. And so momentarily they're dead, at least their heart has stopped. And when your heart stops, roughly 30 seconds later, the electrical activity in the cortex is flat. And the person is told that if they go out of body and they float up above the operating table sufficiently high that people can't see what's above that, that there's a screen that is showing a picture. And would they please, out of body, look at the picture, remember it. When they come back into their body and their heart has started up again, they'll be asked, did you float out of your body and did you see a picture? So this is a very long-term experiment because people don't report these kinds of out-of-body experiences very often, or at least often enough under predictable circumstances. I don't know what the results yet are of this experiment, but I know it's an ongoing experiment. It's a way, it's a quasi-scientific way of testing whether people are actually out-of-body. There are people who can generate an out-of-body experience, but not under conditions where their brain or their body has stopped. They just lay down and go out of body and go visit other places. Those studies, there's just a smidgen of research to see whether or not what they see at a distance is verifiably true. And the problem with those studies is that we know that clairvoyance is true. And so there's a confound in knowing that you can see things without actually having a sense that your body is there. If you have your sense that your body is also there, that you've traveled to go to it, well, maybe that's an illusion. We don't have a good way of discriminating between the body, a body going somewhere, like a subtle body, and simply your ability to perceive something at a distance. So this is a tricky area to study, mainly because you don't want to put people in danger without some necessity for it. And so most of the research on near-death experience, the vast majority of it is spontaneous. And it's a very, very slow process then to do science when you're dealing with spontaneous effects. That's why oftentimes a lot of the really interesting things that people tell me about, I say, well, I don't know how to do that in the laboratory because I would either end up putting somebody in danger in the process of studying it, or they can't do it even if we could put somebody in danger. So basically, that's our limitations in terms of what we can study.